Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about a new US government warning about North Korean IT workers getting jobs by posing as citizens of other countries, and how the Conti ransomware gang is threatening to overthrow the government of Costa Rica. But first, let's turn to you, Bridget, because you were working on a white paper recently, which was all about Chinese cyber espionage. So maybe you could tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, sure, Dick, I will. So I was working on this paper with help from some of our other colleagues on the Threat Hunter team. And for a good few months, really, it was quite a kind of in-depth look into kind of cyber espionage activity that we've seen, I suppose, emanating from China over the last kind of year and a half. So in it, really, we give a fairly comprehensive view of the kind of activity that we've seen coming out of China, the kind of threat groups, mostly thought to be kind of state-backed, who are operating out of the country, and the sort of activity we have seen carried out by them recently.
Okay, I've seen this paper, and it's a pretty chunky one, but could you maybe tell us about some of the key findings that you made?
Yeah, I suppose one of the key things that we have to remember when looking at the activity of Chinese cyber actors generally is that there can be a significant amount of overlap between some Chinese APT groups, between many of the Chinese APT groups, really. And I suppose these Chinese groups, these state-sponsored groups, they're known to use a lot of often contractors, and some movement between groups can sometimes happen. And this leads then to the sharing of tactics, tools, and procedures, potentially between different China-backed groups. That's something we see quite a lot as well. And this can make attributing activity to a specific attack group quite difficult. And we will see an example of that when we talk about APT41, which, for example, we track as two groups, but other vendors track under just one umbrella. And I suppose as well, what's clear in this paper is that Chinese threat actors, they really still have, you know, they still have the skills, they still have the resources to, you know, carry out quite sophisticated activity, to develop custom malware, you know, like the highly sophisticated Daxam malware that we discovered, and which we dedicated a whole podcast episode to, I think, in March.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good example of their capabilities. All right. You mentioned APT41 there. So do you want to fill us in a little bit more about your findings on that group?
Yeah, so APT41, it's probably one of the most kind of long-standing, I would say, nearly really Chinese APT groups. They've been active since about 2010, going by most estimates, I think. And there can be, there can be a certain amount of crossover between Chinese APT groups. And this can sometimes lead to, I suppose, you know, disagreements of a sort between different security vendors about whether or not groups are affiliated or whether they operate separately. Or whether it's all one group or it's multiple kind of smaller groups, or kind of what's the setup in that sense. So an example of this is the fact that we track APT41 as two distinct subgroups, Blackfly and Greyfly, whereas some vendors do simply track all this activity just under the umbrella of APT41. So we kind of make the differentiation that we consider Blackfly to be involved in cybercrime also, whereas Greyfly does appear to be an arm of APT41 that is only interested in cyber espionage. So Blackfly has been around since at least 2010, and it was initially known quite famously to primarily target organizations in the gaming industry. And this appears to be both for financial and espionage purposes. And Blackfly is kind of unusual in that regard. It's unusual in the fact that it's believed to carry out attacks for financial purposes, which is not something we typically see state-backed actors doing. You know, generally the only kind of APT groups we see carrying out financially motivated attacks are those originating from North Korea, you know, and that's generally considered to be driven by the sort of unique, you know, place that that country kind of holds on the world stage, and the fact that the government there can look to make money from different purposes. And so it is possible, we think, though, that these Blackfly attacks, it's possible that the financially motivated attacks carried out by Blackfly may be, you know, sort of side projects potentially of some of the contractors working for the group. You know, they may be leveraging their access to networks to try and make some extra money for themselves. You know, it's not clear it's really the core aim of the group. But between 2011 and 2015, then we saw private code signing certificates that were almost certainly stolen from computer game firms by Blackfly being used to sign custom malware that was being used in cyber espionage activity that we believe was carried out by Greyfly. So this is where the kind of link between the two groups sort of became apparent at first, I suppose.
I see. And you have some new info, I think, in the form of some previously unpublished case studies about these groups in the paper as well, don't you?
Yeah, so we carried a couple of case studies about this activity, the group APT41 activity, I suppose. So we had a case study relating to an APT41 campaign that targeted organizations in various different sectors in Taiwan, which is a very kind of common target of a Chinese espionage activity between April and December last year, April and December 2021. So and while we were able to link this activity to APT41, we weren't able to determine if it was the Blackfly or the Greyfly subgrouping. The motivation did appear to be cyber espionage, but we couldn't say for 100% if it was Blackfly or Greyfly which was behind it, but it was definitely APT41 activity. And the victims targeted in this campaign, they were in a number of sectors, as I said. They were in the healthcare, education, manufacturing, as well as the air transportation sectors. And the first activity in this campaign we saw in April, and then the most recent was last December. And while the amount of time spent on the victim networks, it varied. You know, there were days on some networks, there were months on other networks. In at least one case, the attackers were able to maintain a presence on a victim network for as long as 6 months, which is a significant amount of time for an attacker to have access to a network. And we were able to link this activity to APT41 due to the use of the Trojan Dash Tortilla malware, which is a known APT41 loader. And as well as that, we did also see some domain overlap and some technique overlap with previous APT41 activity as well. And then we also detailed a campaign where a telecommunications company in the Middle East, in this case, was targeted in an attack campaign that went on from the middle of 2021 to early 2022. And while the payloads in this case were unknown, there were some similarities and clues that pointed to a shared malware used by both Blackfly and Greyfly. And at least one instance, the attackers were able to access a system with software for mobile carrier-related servers and gateways, including high availability devices to manage mobile network elements. And both custom malware and living off the land techniques and tactics were deployed in this campaign. And again, we saw some technique overlap between this campaign and previous activity that's believed to have been carried out by APT41, as well as use of custom malwares that were also custom loaders, I should say, that were also reportedly used in the previous APT41 activity. And this campaign was interesting because it was very highly targeted, as the loaders would only run once they had verified the system information of the machines that they were on. So this indicates that the attackers had carried out potentially a good bit of reconnaissance about the victim organizations before they carried out this campaign. And the steps taken by the attackers to try and hide their activity included things like time stomping, and they also deleted .dat files. So this all kind of, after they were finished, I suppose, the machines. So it all kind of indicated that this campaign, you know, was the work of a pretty experienced and sophisticated actor. So it was all pretty much pointing towards APT groups in that sense as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's just APT41. There was lots of other threat actors you profiled in the paper. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about who they were?
Yeah, we profiled several threat actors. And one of the groups we profiled was Atorine, which is also known as Softcell or Gallium. And this is kind of an interesting group. It's a cyber espionage group that appears to be focused very closely on the surveillance of individuals. And it seems to be optimized for kind of low cost but high impact operations. And I think it's kind of interesting, as its typical toolkit doesn't appear to include custom malware. Rather, it relies on kind of Julius tools, off-the-shelf malware that has been a bit modified. You know, so that's kind of interesting. You know, typically with Chinese groups, we do see them using custom malware, but not in this case. However, you know, despite that, it doesn't mean that they're a non-skilled group, because although they don't develop their own malware, they do reportedly have access to zero-day exploits. And they're one of the groups that was reportedly exploiting the proxy logon vulnerabilities before they became publicly known, indicating that they may have had kind of earlier knowledge of those vulnerabilities potentially. Now, the first group that exploited the proxy logon vulnerabilities was a Chinese threat group that Symantec tracks as ANT, also known as Hafnium. So given the high degree of crossover between Chinese APT groups, you know, it's possible that contractors working for ANT may also have worked with a Tory, possibly supplying knowledge of those vulnerabilities to them. However, you know, how this group gained knowledge of the proxy logon bugs in advance of public reporting isn't clear. That's just kind of speculation. But its use of common hacking and dual use tools, they obviously make its activity harder to identify, harder to attribute, which seems to be kind of a priority for this group, which has had victims in several sectors, including telecoms, government and education sectors. And with public reporting suggesting that the group has targeted telecoms organisations in order to facilitate surveillance of individuals, as in the telecoms company's customers. And I suppose, again, as another example of the overlap we have noted as, you know, kind of being a feature of Chinese APT groups, Symantec has also found some potential evidence. I think it's been publicly reported as well that Atorine and Blackfly may share some of the same tooling. So the kind of, you know, potential overlap exists there between lots of different Chinese stock groups. And as well, another kind of one of the groups we discuss is Slug, which is also known as the L proxy group, whose malware was seen being used alongside the Daxon backdoor that we already mentioned in two instances. And we also discussed two groups we have written blogs about in the last year and probably have previously discussed on the podcast. Antline, which is also known as Tropic Thunder or APT23, and Cicada, which is also known as APT10. So we feature a case study of our recent blog on Cicada, where we detail how the group appears to be widening its activity. Now, Cicada has been known, you know, in the past to have a very strong focus on both managed service providers as well as companies that have links to Japan. But this more recent activity had included victims in government, legal, religious, and non-governmental organizations in multiple countries around the world, including in Europe and Asia and North America. So kind of indicated maybe kind of a widening of that group's targeting. And we also discussed as well that an Antline campaign that saw the group target financial institutions in Taiwan in a campaign that went on for 18 months. And in that campaign, the attackers deployed a custom backdoor that we call XPAC on compromised systems, which gave them extensive access to victim machines, with the goal of that campaign appearing to have an espionage. And I think, you know, those are just some of the, I think, 11 or 12 maybe groups that we profile in the paper. And we do also discuss Daxon at some length as well, but I won't get into that here now because we do already have a whole podcast dedicated to that in our library, where it's discussed by our much more knowledgeable colleague, Piotr. So that might be a better reference for people if they're interested in that group, that activity.
Yeah, I've always found it interesting, or the blurred lines between lots of Chinese activities. So it's interesting to hear more perspective on it there, whether it's like contractors moving around or people freelancing and stuff like that. It seems to be kind of possibly the way that they work over there. Mm-hmm. All right, and after looking at so many groups, is there any conclusions you were able to come to by the time you were done?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key conclusion really, or one of the key conclusions, is that China continues to be a serious player, you know, in the world of cyber espionage. And it is apparent that groups operating out of China, they still have a lot of kind of firepower, I suppose, behind their activities. You know, the development of the Daxon backdoor is a key indication of that. You know, as is the Cicada activity that we talk about in our case study, which points to that group possibly widening its targeting and expanding in its activity, you know, in a campaign that targeted multiple large organizations in different geographies at the same time. And, you know, that points to a group that is still very well resourced and highly skilled, you know, almost 15 years after its activity was first spotted. So it's clear many of the groups operating out of China, you know, they still have a lot of resources and a lot of skills behind them. And I think as well, you know, I was writing this paper in kind of February, March. So, you know, the geopolitical situation in the world as well may also affect the activity we see coming from China in the future. You know, I mean, the kind of instability and the upheaval that, you know, we're likely to continue to see due to the ongoing, of course, Russian invasion of Ukraine, you know, is likely to continue to impact, you know, obviously the world, but also the cyber world for some time to come. You know, if Russia's invasion of Ukraine combined with things like sanctions and that sort of thing, you know, if that impacts Russia's malicious cyber activity, it may be an opportunity for China to become, you know, potentially kind of even a more powerful operator, I guess, in the world of malicious cyber actors than it is already.
Yeah, you definitely kind of think that they're seeing this some sort of strategic opportunity anyway.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting one to watch. But let's turn to you now, Dick, as you've been looking at some of the stories that have been in the news this week. And the first one is a bit bizarre. I saw this this morning as well. A US government warning about North Korean IT workers surreptitiously obtaining jobs while pretending to be citizens of other countries.
Yeah, this one, it's like it's right out of the Manchurian Candidate. Although at this stage, I suppose we should never be surprised about what emanates from North Korea. So, yes, on Monday, the US government published a warning about an ongoing operation in which thousands of North Korean IT workers are getting jobs by posing as nationals from other countries. So the alert was put out jointly by the Departments of the Treasury, Justice and State. And it said that North Korea encourages these IT workers to apply for jobs abroad. And it's done in order to generate some much needed foreign currency for North Korea's regime. So the workers, what they do is they target freelance contracts, and they'll often hide their location. They'll opt for contracts that involve working remotely. And in some cases, even they then subcontract out that work to IT workers in other countries.
That's interesting that they try to hide the location by working remotely, which is obviously something that has become a lot more kind of common and, you know, acceptable over the last year or two.
I know, it's obviously been a boon for them.
Yeah, it's like worked in their favour. Yeah. And do we have any idea then of what kind of roles they are getting in these activities?
Yeah, it's quite surprising because according to the alert, at least, it seems that they've been involved in quite a diverse amount of sectors. So among the roles they picked up are things such as building virtual currency exchange platforms, online gambling programs, dating applications, AI applications, virtual reality, facial and biometric software, and so on. I mean, you name it, really, they seem to have become involved in it. And they're not just getting junior roles either. So some of these contractors can individually earn up to $300,000 a year. And they estimated that some teams of IT workers were between them earning around $3 million annually collectively. So it's not inconsiderable sums that are being involved here. And you can see its appeal to the North Korean regime, like in terms of like the amount of dollars they can potentially earn. So I guess one of the obvious questions when you hear about this and it's explained to you is what's in it for the workers themselves? Why are they doing it? Well, I guess, like, as we all know, North Korea is highly repressive and it's a tightly controlled state. So you would imagine that a lot of the people involved in this probably don't have much of a choice in what they do. And it may very well be the case that they're still doing relatively well out of it compared to other people in the country. Apparently, the average IT worker involved in this operation is estimated to make at least 10 times as much as your average North Korean worker working in North Korea. So even if they hand over the majority of their earnings to the government, they could still be doing kind of quite well, relatively speaking.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, what are the risks then for companies who might inadvertently employ these people? I know there's kind of legal and tax implications if an employee isn't in the jurisdiction they're supposed to be in. But with North Korea, then I presume it's kind of more serious than that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think in this case, the tax implications is probably going to be the least of your worries. So what the US government said is that there are reputational risks and potential for legal consequences if you inadvertently hire one or more of these North Korean IT workers, because doing so actually might violate US government and United Nations sanctions against the North Korean government. And one of the main reasons for that is that many of these IT workers are working for and sending money to a number of sanctioned entities, including the General Bureau of the Munitions Industry Department, which is responsible for the development of all weapons in North Korea, including nuclear weapons, the Ministry of Atomic Energy, which is also involved in the nuclear weapons program, and several military entities that are linked to either the North Korean Ministry of Defense or its army, and a number of other government entities. So you can kind of see why you may end up being done for sanctions when you see the kinds of organizations the money is ultimately going to. And aside from that, then, while this operation appears to be chiefly a revenue generation exercise, the alert did warn that on some occasions, some of these IT workers apparently have used the privileged access they gained as contractors to facilitate North Korean malicious cyber intrusions. So in other words, they facilitated espionage attacks, in other words. So yeah, it's pretty crazy stuff. Essentially, it's like if you don't do your due diligence while hiring a remote contractor, you could be inadvertently funding the North Korean nuclear weapons program.
Wow, I mean, there's good motivation to do your due diligence. So if you're hiring, and it's all the bizarre news with you this week, Dick. So I suppose from one piece to another, the Conti ransomware group is threatening to overthrow the government of Costa Rica.
Regime change is probably not exactly known as one of the core competencies of Conti. But yeah, this one has been simmering away actually for quite a while now, for a few weeks. And once you go beyond the headlines, it starts to make a little bit more sense. I just say a little bit. So the story originally broke towards the end of last month when the government of Costa Rica confirmed that it had been hit with a ransomware attack. The then president said that the ransomware attack was intended to, quote, threaten the stability of the country in a transition situation. It was a transition situation because the then president, Carlos Quesada, was due to shortly hand over the presidency to Rodrigo Chavez, who had won a presidential election on April 4th. So he said, Quesada said that Costa Rica wasn't going to pay the $10 million ransom demand. And he said, this is not just an attack on the institutions affected. It's a criminal cyber attack on the state and the entire country. And the attack was quite disruptive. It appears to have hit multiple government institutions, including the country's Ministry for Finance. Because of that, some of the systems affected were the country's customs service, and that created lots of delays with imports and exports. And even a few weeks ago, exporters estimated that they'd lost more than $200 million worth of revenues due to all of this disruption. So what has happened since the attack is that essentially a standoff with the Costa Rican government refusing to pay and Conti making ever more threatening noises. And the reason it's in the news again is that Conti put up another warning on their website this week. And they said, we are determined to overthrow the government by means of a cyber attack. We've already shown you all the strength and power. We have our insiders in your government. We are also working on gaining access to your other systems. You will have no other options to pay us. And then Chavez, who has now taken over as president, actually seemed to kind of confirm some of the claims that Conti made, because he said that there are collaborators within Costa Rica who are helping Conti. He didn't reveal who these collaborators are, but he said there are very clear indications that people are inside the country are collaborating. So now Conti has upped its demands. They're asking now for $20 million from the Costa Rican government. So they essentially doubled their ransom demand. And they've also threatened that the decryption keys will be deleted within a week if the ransom is not paid. So it's really eating up down in Costa Rica.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sticky situation for them, because obviously governments don't want to be getting extorted by criminals. But then if they don't get a decryption key, it could be a serious impact and cost them an awful lot to recover as well.
Yeah, and there is the risk of further further attacks if their their claims are true about having insiders.
Absolutely.
So yeah, one to watch anyway. But let's leave it there. I think we're nearly out of time. If you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.